The E-Commerce Fuel Podcast is brought to you by Fulfill.io. Imagine for a minute that you had a central business brain that looked at every facet of your e-commerce operation, shipping, ordering inventory, accounting, everything to help you make better decisions. Not just about growing your top line revenue, but about being profitable. If that sounds compelling, you should check out Fulfill.io. They're the only cloud ERP designed to help you efficiently and most importantly, profitably scale your eight or nine figure brand. They do that through better forecasting, smart supply chain planning, identifying operational bottlenecks that you can go in and solve to open up the full potential of your business, and also a really powerful and incredible warehouse management system for reduced misships and mispicks for better customer experience. And they're the highest rated ERP among e-commerce fuel members, not NetSuite, not Skubana, not Odoo, but Fulfill. So if you're interested in growing, but growing profitably, you'll definitely want to check them out. And you can do that at ecommercefuel.com/fulfill. The E-Commerce Fuel Podcast is brought to you by One-Click Upsell, the most popular, largest upsell app in the Shopify marketplace, trusted by over 11,000 users, over 1,900 of those big spending Shopify Plus stores. And they've generated over $200 million in revenue for the merchants that use them. And you may be thinking, oh, hey, Andrew, I've heard of One-Click Upsell. I know these guys, but do you really? Do you know what they've rolled out recently? They've got some cool new stuff for their pre-purchase and their post-purchase upsells. You can now select from multiple different offers to present your customers. So instead of having them just have to pick from one single thing, you can give them the option to pick from multiple upsells, which helps and has proven to increase the number of people who actually take you up on those upsells. So if you're not using upsells in your store, it's an amazingly easy, fast way to increase your average order value and your revenues. So check them out at ecommercefuel.com/upsell. Hey, it's Andrew here, and welcome to the E-Commerce Fuel Podcast, the show dedicated to helping seven and eight-figure e-commerce brand owners build incredible businesses and amazing lives. And excited for today's episode, I have a good friend on the show, actually returning. We did an episode maybe a couple, two, 3 years ago about living in a couple different places. We'll link up to that. But Danny Kirk, he is the owner and the founder of Kirk Co., which is a company that specializes in outbound cold email, as well as Prompt Pod, which is a podcast focused on prompt engineering. And excited to have Danny on because he's a good friend, lives in Tucson. I actually moved just down, just a couple blocks away recently. And apart from having just full license to be able to razz him on all sorts of things, which always makes the episode super fun, just smart guy, and knows more about outbound cold email, which is something I think as an e-commerce store owner is not really on anyone's radar. And so I always think it's interesting when there's kind of strategies and tactics and acquisition methods that are very don't really get a lot of playtime. And I thought I'd be curious to dive into that. And also how he is using AI in general with those efforts, both for outbound cold B2B email gen, but also just kind of in his business and with some of the learnings he's had from the prompt pod that he hosts. So anyway, big intro there. But Danny, welcome, man. Good to have you back. And I was thinking, we're doing this on the computer. I was thinking right before we recorded, like, why we should have done this in the office here in person. I should have set that up, man. Or at your new house, because you just moved. You just spent an unholy amount of time and money remodeling a house. Congratulations on that. Congrats on all the things.
Andrew, thanks for having me on. Yeah, I'm excited to do this.
Yeah. How are you feeling before we get into the thick of it? You've been in this new house for like 2-3 weeks, like massive, what was it? 4 month, 5 month, three, I guess, it was actually pretty fast. You pretty much gutted a 1920s house and brought it up to code over the course of the last, half a year-ish. Yeah. You feeling like a little more grounded now that all that the entire whirlwind is behind you?
Yeah, it was only 5 months long, and truth be told, that's a pretty short amount of time, but it was sheer purgatory when we were in it. So it felt more like 2 years. I'm thankful it was only 5 months, but we're excited about it. And other than the Sunday night drum circles in the park that is across the street from you and I, it's a pretty good deal.
You don't like you don't like those drum circles? I love those drum circles.
I think they go on way too long. I mean, what's going on over there?
Oh man, Danny, 35 going on 87. I love the sound of the drums kind of floating into our yard. I think it's kind of part of the flavor of the neighborhood.
Can't win them all, I guess, right?
And the last thing before we jump in, the Well, actually, no. Let's get into it because yours, you know a ton about this. Outbound cold email. How long have you been doing this for?
Yeah, probably at least 12 years. I mean, you know, I've been sending shameless emails to people that have gotten low response rates for a long time. So if that's the measure of how long I've been doing it, I guess I'm 35 years old now. So maybe 2 decades.
And so outbound cold email, is it usually mostly B2B or is it for anything? What's your specialty or what do you have you focused on?
I only focus on B2B, and that's kind of by default, not by intention, or at least to start. I had a software company about 12 years ago, and you know, we just had to go shake the trees to get customers, and that's where I learned about cold emailing. That company was in the B2B space, so I've just been doing it since. Nothing against B2C. Kind of wish I would have gotten into it, honestly, but yeah, my expertise is on the B2B side of things.
Are there people doing this for B2C? Like if somebody's selling, I don't know, essential oils or shampoo or I don't know, anything that's not a B2B product, does it work well? Are there people in the space that do it for B2C or is it primarily a B2B thing?
It's primarily a B2B thing. The problem is that with B2C, usually you're emailing people on their personal addresses. They're at Gmail, at Outlook, and those personal inboxes that aren't on domains have different spam rules and are a lot stricter. I assume that if any of your listeners go check their work email spam and then go check their Gmail spam, the Gmail spam folder is way fuller than the work one. So it's really hard to reach those personal inboxes. Yet again, it's not a reason I don't do it, but that's just much harder to do. So as your listeners know, it's much easier just to have an opt-in list and do a newsletter versus cold email campaigns to B2C leads.
Got it. So I think about like my email address, which is at ecommercefuel.com, but it's actually hosted by Gmail. So it comes through Gmail. So is Gmail, so would it be harder for someone to reach me with cold direct email for B2B because it's kind of getting filtered through Gmail's servers or not necessarily?
Admittedly, it's all a black box. So I don't have the actual answers. It's all kind of seeing what is working and talking to my peers in the space. We do kind of get the feeling that, yes, I agree with you. You know, mine, I use Google as well for my ESP for Kirk & Co. But I do get the feeling that emailing my @gmail.com has a much higher spam flagging rate than my @kirkco.io, if that makes sense. So even though they're both still Google, I do believe those personal ones have different settings and filters. And as an example of this, my work email does not have a promotions tab or anything like that. My personal email does have a promotions tab. So yet again, if there's a newsletter, if it went to my work email, it would go to the inbox, hopefully. But with @gmail.com, it would go to the promotions tab sometimes or most of the time.
Interesting. Okay. So I think a lot of people assume that just cold outbound email is just not effective. Like I think about my inbox and I'm just ruthless. Like if I don't recognize somebody's name, if the subject line does not speak to me either because of an interest, something that's interesting or something that is relevant to a conversation I've had, I'm just ruthless. A lot of times I'll delete something within 2 seconds of seeing it if something doesn't pop out at me in terms of connection. So obviously, it's effective, like you're doing it, but what do you need to do to make it effective? Because there's so much noise in the inbox. So maybe that's where we can start. What are the things you have to get right to actually make this be a viable strategy?
Yeah, you know, first of all, it's all about the company and their offering. We can't create success for a company with a poor product or service that either doesn't have product market fit or just has horrible branding or whatever it might be. We're not magicians here. I think it was, let me see, who is the famous investor in Texas? Bill Gurley. I think he might have said that his job is not to create amazing companies. It's to pour gasoline on companies that were going to be amazing already. Over the course of like a decade doing this, I feel exactly the same way now. When we look at our outlier successes, and that's probably 3-8% of our clients, like just insane successes, those companies were going to be successful either way we helped. We were just an additional channel to do it for them. So as far as kind of success goes, I think a lot about infrastructure these days. I actually just did a post on LinkedIn this morning about, it was actually from a different cold email platform that was cold emailing me to pitch their platform, and it went to my spam folder. Now, nothing says spam more than landing in a spam folder. So if you can just avoid the spam folder and actually get to the inbox, you know, you're doing a lot better than most people. So to me these days, it's all about warming networks. It's all about good deliverability, ensuring that my clients get to the inbox with 40 to 90% open rates. That's kind of my main key to success there. And then after that, it's all about psychology of wording, but it's really about the foundational layer of the setup of the system to start with.
Yeah. Talk about, so a warming list. I think most people listening are pretty familiar with deliverability in terms of email deliverability. And so we can get into that maybe a little bit, but warming is a little bit less well known, I think. Can you talk about what that means and how that works?
Yeah. So warming is the act of either manually or automatically sending messages from your sending inboxes to other inboxes that will respond in a favorable way. And then the ESPs, the email service providers, will look at that interaction and rate your inbox with a favorable score. Now, back some years ago, before all these fancy warming networks, we would do this manually. We would have some tricks. I had a list of about 2,000 hotels around the world. And I would ask them, hey, do you have availability for 4 people next weekend?
And this would be for maybe for like a new address that has not, like a brand new address, you're trying to create credibility and authority is the wrong word, but you're trying to make it be a known list to the email service providers, right?
Exactly. The brand new ones is most critical. Of course, we still do warm in perpetuity for ones that we've been sending from just because that's a best practice. But yeah, it is mainly for the new ones before we start the campaign. So that used to be a manual process. And now we're using warming networks. So there are software tools out there that, you know, are like $5 a month per inbox. You hook it up and they have automatic interactions between different ESPs and whatnot.
Interesting. Okay. What are some of the names of some of those warming networks?
Yeah, I use, I'm a big GrowBots user. So their warming network is called WarmBots, but then there's WarmUp Inbox, WarmUp Email. I think literally if you combined any of those names together and typed it in, you would find a warming network these days. They're all doing pretty much the same thing. So they have inboxes and connect to the other sending addresses, but they have multiple ESPs they're replying from. So they're kind of giving a broad spectrum of good deliverability.
Interesting. And how long does it take to warm up a brand new email address you're going to send from? Like how many messages? What's the time horizon?
I tell my clients at least 2 weeks. Now, sometimes it can be a couple of days, but I like to give it 2 weeks before we start sending the campaign. There's nothing more painful than having to pause a campaign or stop it and start warming again once you've kind of hit the go button. So I like a minimum of at least 2 weeks.
Okay. And you were saying your emails that go out once you're kind of got a campaign up and running, they get open rates between 40 and 90%. Is that right?
Yeah, I would say, you know, anything, if we get in the 30s, I'm starting to get a little bit worried. Anything below that is a red flag to me. So yeah, most of our campaigns these days are definitely in the 40 to 70% range. And I have one right now that's at, you know, over 90%, I believe, last time I checked. So yeah, it's definitely with good deliverability and whatnot. And then obviously, good subject line, good offering, good targeting. That's certainly achievable.
I mean, I have always thought like our community newsletter for our private community where people are, they're paying members. We try to make it really valuable, hovers around a 50% open rate, which I've always been super proud of. And like, so like 80% is just unheard of in my experience, which is impressive, or in 90% even. So how do you get the warmed list or the warmed email address? How targeted are you for, you know, maybe we'll talk about kind of how you get these profiles and the emails and the data sets in a minute here, but how, I'm guessing it's not a spray and pray approach to get those kind of open rates. You got to be, I'm guessing, much more targeted. So how targeted are you with recipients?
Yeah. So looking at our most successful campaigns, they really do have some unique offering to a very well-defined market. And also for lack of a better term, maybe a little bit of a growth hack as well, as far as the messaging goes. So yeah, whenever I get on a discovery call with a potential new client, they're like, oh, hey, yeah, we're actually industry agnostic. I just cringe on the other end. You know, that's not lying, but that's a key to failure in my opinion. So yeah, I do try to get as targeted as possible information from my client so we can prepare wording that is relevant to those kind of industries and titles. We try to dial that in as much as possible.
Got it. Okay. How are you finding these emails? You know, let's say maybe we can use, can we use an example of obviously not one of your clients, but maybe in the rough space? Let's take solar. We're in Arizona here. Let's talk about solar. This may be probably a horrible example, but we'll roll with it. So how do you find, let's say you're trying to reach out to solar companies because you want them to buy, you've got this amazing new solar panel that was just twice as efficient and it will make them much more money. How do you find solar companies, their email addresses, without just hiring someone to go, you know, do unhold, you know, painful amounts of research online? How do you efficiently find the email addresses for decision makers at solar companies?
Yeah, I did some quick Googling. So yeah, it looks like there is no solar industry, but under NACE codes, solar electric power generation is a category. So that's number 221114. So I would go into GrowBots. Most of our clients, probably 95%, are using GrowBots data. So they have their own data set. So we go in there, type in that NACE code, and then be able to target those companies. From there, we could target revenue, geography, things like that. And then on kind of the next page in the system, you would be able to target the titles of the people in those companies you want to.
Interesting. Okay. So GrowBots, this is a tool that is, I've actually used this a little bit as well. It's kind of a built-in data set for all the email addresses, as well as list warming, as well as be able to create campaigns. It's kind of an all-in-one package for running outbound email campaigns.
Yes, it is. I am not a representative of those guys, but I love their team, love the platform. I've used almost every single one under the sun, been with these guys for about 6 years. So all of our clients use them. I highly recommend those guys.
Okay, great. So we've got this list of people in the solar area you can go through. How much do you have to go through and audit the list? I remember when I was going through and doing a campaign for this, because for a while, I did a little experiment where we were trying to build up, proactively reach out to some of the members in cities we wanted to build more active meetup kind of group around, like, for example, you know, New York or Austin or wherever, where we had a pretty good contingent of ECF members, or even where we had maybe like Phoenix, for example. We have a reasonable number of members there, but not quite enough to like have a regular meetup, you know, ongoing basis. Anyway, so we're trying to supplement some cities strategically with membership, and we can kind of get into maybe why that didn't work out for what we were trying to do. But I remember having to go through and doing a lot of reviewing all the contacts that we were going to send out to manually to make sure that they were a good fit. How much scrubbing of the data do you have to do? Are you able to go in and actually get 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 lists or names that are pretty high quality, or do you have to do a lot of scrubbing?
So ideally, I am not doing a lot of scrubbing. So if I get to the prospecting tab of GrowBots and, you know, half the leads are not relevant and I'm clicking no on them, that means I've done a poor job targeting. So if that does happen, I go back to the drawing board and try to refine my targeting, because I'm trying to kind of do work once and then not have to do it again. So yeah, I'm really trying to refine the targeting in the system so that most of the leads that show up in the prospecting tab, I can just accept and launch them into the campaign. That's the ideal scenario.
Got it. Okay. So most of them are in there. Let's say you get 90% that are great. Do you still go through and scrub the entire list to ensure deliverability and like relevance is as high as possible? Or if you're going through and you go through 50 names and, you know, let's say 45 of them are a great fit, you just roll with the rest of it?
I usually do roll with the rest of it. I'm trying to kind of assure it on the setup end and then just kind of trust the process from there. Now, over time, if we're not seeing good results, we will revisit the targeting and make changes or change it completely. On the data side of things, GrowBots handles the scrubbing and the verifiability of the data. So they are pinging those addresses and making sure they're valid. If any come back as unvalid or bouncing, they credit the account back. So that's kind of one of my favorite features. You don't have to handle any lists or anything like that. It's essentially, or effectively on the customer side, a zero bounce system, because they credit your account back for any bad data that they had on their end.
Got it. Okay. So you get the list all locked in. That first email, and I'm kind of putting you on the spot here a little bit, I realize, but how would you think about the subject line? How would you think about the body of the email, who it comes from? And maybe, you know, I know from an offer perspective, let's just for the sake of argument say their offer is, we have solar panels that are, you know, twice as effective, or let's say 50% more effective in terms of converting the sun into electricity, which is a pretty compelling offer. So how would you think about putting that first email together to outreach?
And are you talking, just to go back to the target, are you talking about we're emailing, oh yeah, so we are the solar panel provider, we're trying to reach out to solar installers, is that right?
Yeah, let's say we're trying to reach out to solar installers so that they can buy and recommend our product. So, you know, this is probably anyone who's actually in the solar industry is probably just cringing and rubbing their temple right now. Because this is not how it works.
These guys don't know anything about solar.
Yeah, wow, a bunch of total noobs here. Let's say that you're reaching out to solar, like wholesalers, like people who would buy your solar panels in bulk. So either installers who own their own inventory, or maybe wholesalers that kind of distribute throughout the country. But you are the OEM manufacturer of them.
Yeah, so I'm a big believer in loss aversion psychology for our sequences. So everything kind of revolves around that besides a growth hack in the messaging. So first of all, I'm trying to think on the solar installer side of things, what keeps them up at night? It's probably the idea that they were installing poor quality panels or panels that didn't last long or didn't have good efficiencies for their customers, which means they don't recommend them. They don't have that word of mouth effect. They get poor reviews online. Their business goes downhill. Things like that is the wording I would kind of use in that sequence. Does that make sense so far?
It does. Yeah. So the subject line, and again, and realizing I'm kind of just putting you right here. So your subject line, would it center around that loss aversion, or are you in that subject, are you trying to really tie into that right away, or just get them to open the email and then you kind of have a little more time, of course, to kind of sell them on why their business is going to collapse if they don't take your product?
So first of all, don't do any false positives, or don't incentivize for false positives. Yeah, any of us can create a subject line that will get, you know, insane open rates, but that doesn't mean it's relevant and it will be immediately marked as spam and you will burn the domain. So don't incentivize for false positives. Actually have it describe the message in the body. I would actually do an A-B test on the subject lines. I would have one with loss aversion wording and one with upside potential wording, because although I do have, you know, kind of my tips and tricks that I have learned over a decade doing this, that doesn't mean it's going to work or that it's right. So I also want to be testing the opposite of that. So I would do one that's kind of loss aversion, like, hey, worried about your panel quality, first name, ? And then one that is like, you know, these new panels are 400% more efficient. I have no idea. Yet again, somebody's cringing on the listening to this, but I would test the two against each other.
Personalization, even the little with your A-B split tests, that's something that I realized with our email list. We haven't asked for a name for years. We just have done the email because for, you know, easy opt-in, but want to get back to that from a personalized standpoint. How important do you think is personalizing? Even if it's something as small and trite as just having the name in the subject line or addressing them by name in the email, even if they know it's on.
Man, people are going to hate me on this, but from what I have seen, personalization doesn't have anything to do with results, as is compared to good targeting, good product you're offering. The thing that happens with personalization is that you get false positives. So I've, you know, just took over an account right now that has a high level of personalization based on background of leads they scraped from LinkedIn. They get a ton of warm replies, but none of them are going to a call. It's just like, hey, yeah, I like this thing that you like too. Thanks for mentioning it. But none of them go to a call. So it's, to me, like, that kind of makes me cringe. Yet again, that sort of thing is not paying the bills for my clients, which means they're not paying me. I would say also a lot of our best campaigns have really just had good loss aversion wording, but a great growth hack as well. We have one campaign right now for a company that does retreats, like offsite retreats and things like that. And they have found that there are places where the local tourism board will literally pay, you know, like $15,000 for people to come and do their offsite retreat there. Like, that's a growth hack. They have this special knowledge, and we are now marketing that, and they are drowning in leads. So literally, the first name is the only personalization in that email. Does that make sense?
It does. So by growth hack, you mean like kind of some kind of like very compelling special offer or, you know, third party information that, okay. So something that's a little bit, not just a generic offer, but something that's an amazingly juicy offer that people can't resist is kind of what you're referring to.
Exactly. And I think that goes for any type of marketing here. I mean, this could be any different channel with any different professional. And I don't think any professional out there can really create magic for any brand. The brand does have to have a good offering to begin with. So it's not surprising that our best campaigns do have some incredible special offer. And then from there, we're just using our kind of tricks as far as wording goes to really drive those conversions.
Hey, Andrew here with a little aside. If you're listening, you're obviously interested in e-commerce. And so I want to make sure you know about our private community for 7- and 8-figure e-commerce brands at E-Commerce Fuel. And the secret sauce, like you might guess, is it's limited to people who own stores, who are in the trenches, practitioners doing this stuff. It's a very curated community, which has three big benefits. First, it means everyone inside can help get fast, on-point answers to your most important questions. If you're trying to decide if SMS is a tool worth rolling out, if you just got suspended on Amazon, if you're trying to hire a director of e-commerce, these are all things that either people have experience with or have gone through in the forums. And if you post and ask questions, you'll get answers within hours, sometimes even minutes, as well as being able to tap into close to a decade of archive discussions. So you get a lot of insights, fast answers to pressing questions. You get to plug into an amazing network of over 1,100 experienced e-commerce entrepreneurs. So you can reach out to people. If you're in e-commerce Fuel, our members are incredibly giving and generous. And so if you want to reach out to someone with expertise, oftentimes we'd be happy to share what they know. If you're, you know, traveling, hopefully when traveling is a common thing again, a lot of our members would hit in the city, you know, DC, Dallas, Sydney, Australia, you know, London, wherever it is, and be able to have someone on the ground you can connect with or maybe grab a beer with. It's an amazing network. And then finally, we've got a huge user-generated review library with over 10,000 reviews on agencies, software, e-commerce software that you can tap into to avoid costly hiring and software mistakes. Nothing is worse than spending 3 months with an agency to onboard only to find out that a bunch of people already tried them and they were horrible and they wasted a bunch of your money and your life. So those are the kind of things you can avoid tapping into the unbiased reviews and experiences of our members with our software directory. So if any of this sounds interesting to you, you should join us at ecommercefuel.com. You can learn more. You can apply for membership there. We also have a 5x ROI guarantee. If you own a 7- or 8-figure brand and your membership fees for our community don't pay for themselves at least 5 times over the course of the first year, we'll refund it completely as well as send you $1,000 just for the wasted time. So ecommercefuel.com, check it out. We'd love to have you apply, potentially join the community. All right, back to the discussion.
So you start sending that out. What does the body of the email look like? The first body, like in terms of length, short and sweet, how much are you trying to maybe allude to something to say, hey, if you want to learn more about this, hit me back up, like maybe dangling the details about that growth hack / very juicy offer. How do you think about writing the body of the email to get people to, and I'm guessing the first thing for them to do is not to book a call, it's just to write back and start the conversation. So those thoughts on those two.
Yep, exactly. So kind of first and foremost, it depends on what the client wants. Maybe they do just want the highest call booking rate possible, and we just strive for that in every single email. Maybe they want a link click. As much as I hate links in emails, we will follow that direction if they want it. So I definitely defer to what their goals are. Now, from there, short and sweet, less than 5 sentences, what would I text a friend? Obviously, all of us get these really cringy emails that sound very formal. Yeah, the most informal emails are kind of performing best. It's like, what would I send a message in a text format to a friend? Now, from there, 1 question mark, no links if possible. Don't give them all the information. You will give them all the information on the call or from the website. You want to pique their interest. You want to drive a knife into that pain they're experiencing and kind of give them the hint.
Wow. Exactly. Oh man, you really got real there for a minute. Okay, yeah. I see how you operate.
Yeah, exactly.
We may be hanging out a little less going forward.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
At least when my children are home.
Yeah, Danny talks a lot about downside. But yeah, really, you know, I do believe, I mean, you know, loss aversion is the strongest driver in human psychology. You know, losing your job, your house, your company that you built, you know, things like that are what people worry about and what they respond to. And if they are worrying about those things and you may have the solution, they are probably going to respond to it. Yeah, you could put a cute gif of a cat in the email too. That will probably get a lot of opens, but I'm not quite sure that would get the same responses. So that's kind of what we're going after.
Don't let people enjoy their Friday night barbecuing. Remind them that their business is on the cusp of a cliff and just drive that knife right into that point.
Yeah, I don't get invited to too many friends' dinners.
Okay, so you mentioned you hate links. Why do you hate links? Is it because it's super tempting? It's too tempting to be like, hey, here's everything. And because people can self-answer, because it reduces the chance they write you back because of deliverability, because of all the above.
Yeah, but mainly, I don't personally hate links. Mainly, the thing is that it does hurt deliverability, or what we are seeing is that it hurts deliverability. Yet again, ESPs don't outright say any of this. So we think it does hurt deliverability. Also, people are pretty link shy these days. I'm sure you know plenty of people at large organizations that are taking classes on not clicking links in email from a security perspective. So they're literally being taught not to click links. And then probably the next kind of subject to touch on is decision fatigue. So links are kind of like infinite decision. You know, follow this link to learn more versus like, hey, are you having this problem? ? And they're able to answer just that question. Or, hey, are you available at 1 p.m. on Tuesday for a call? And they're able to say yes, no. So doing away with decision fatigue is always a best practice. And links are just kind of like a rabbit hole and kind of like infinite decisions.
Interesting. Okay. And then so from there, we've got targeted, we sent the email, ask a question. And there's different goals depending on what your clients want to drive. And then from there, I guess also your client's going to depend on if they want people to, do you usually have people, how many of the, what you're doing end up in a phone call versus just sending people after maybe a follow-up email or two to a website to be able to sign up or purchase or book digitally versus over the phone? Are a lot of these kind of resulting the end of the line, so to speak, is a phone call versus digital?
The phone call is where all of them are going to. Now, I have nothing against links or auto subscribing or things like that. The thing is that, you know, our services cost a certain amount. So we engage with clients that are charging enough for their services where our standard conversion rates will have a positive outcome in all likelihood for them. So yeah, most of those things do require a demo call. It's probably in the mid to enterprise level of products or services. So that's just kind of like our sweet spot as far as like what we like to market with a B2B focus.
Got it. Okay. So a lot of this stuff is really going to make, is this something that like an e-commerce story? Let's say you've got someone who sells B2B and they have obviously the higher lifetime value, the better it's going to work. But where is any thoughts on if someone's going to like hire you or even do this in-house, where does it make sense from an ROI perspective for a lifetime value of a client to actually have this be a viable strategy?
Yeah, it's definitely in LTVs in the thousands for sure. It always feels like minimum $5,000 probably, and very much upwards of there. Have a few clients these days that if they get one lead a year, it's going to pay like, you know, 10x more than what we cost. So the higher, the better in my opinion. But yeah, definitely in the mid thousands.
What's an average engagement for something like this? Let's say you send, I don't know, let's say you send, to make the math easy, 100,000 emails. It's probably overly large, but it'll make the math simple. What's like you mentioned open rates. What's an actual, like as you go down that funnel, percent of people that actually engage, percent of people that actually kind of like end up buying, what's a conversion rate, for lack of a better term, on something like this that's reasonable?
Yeah. So, open rates are the leading indicator, but they do not pay the bills. So that's just something that I'm kind of watching to make sure the system is set up correctly. The kind of gold standard KPI is the warm reply rate. The industry has a baseline of success at 1%. If you can be delivering 1% warm replies at scale, then you will be doing very well. So that's what we're trying to achieve. You know, that's kind of the math that I'm telling my clients. I don't want to overpromise. We do have some campaigns in the 3-4% warm reply rate right now. My highest ever is 18% warm reply rate. So, but 1% is kind of like the baseline that is like easy math and also conservative math.
Interesting. And you've started using ChatGPT like along with so many of us to do things. Talk a little bit about how you've been using ChatGPT to craft your prompts and just for the whole process in general. How's that been tying in?
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, I'm an enthusiast of AI. GrowBots has a very simple AI that I have been, you know, using for 5 or 6 years now. It auto schedules your campaigns for you, so you don't have to worry about that beforehand. You would be having to schedule them out and reschedule them. It has demographic data, so it claims to know when people are most likely to respond. Very simple AI, but I've been an AI enthusiast for a while now. ChatGPT, now we're using it on the copywriting side of things. So, you know, before we would be producing A and B sequences to kind of test against each other. Sometimes, you know, depending on how many clients we have onboarded at any one time, that could take a week to turn around. You know, my team is pretty small and lean. So now with ChatGPT, we can toss in our onboarding survey that we get from all of our clients in text format, put that into ChatGPT. We have our formatting that we like as far as our sequences go in general. We can put those two together and it can spit out a result that is, you know, probably 80% there. Then we can make our edits from there, taking it down from, you know, maybe a week turnaround down to like an hour or so.
Wow. So is this something where you have a questionnaire? What are the pain points people experience? What is your problem offer solve? I'm guessing all these type of questions. You just take that, drop that in, and that will, and I'm sure you've kind of given it a few examples ahead of time. So it kind of knows what you're looking for, but it will go through the inputs on the survey to write the emails and the subject lines for you, at least for a starting point you can work from.
Exactly. Yeah, I prefer gathering that information from the client in high fidelity, so in their own words. And then, yeah, we have kind of pre-trained some of our kind of threads in ChatGPT on some of our best campaigns, and then we kind of put the two pieces together. Sometimes it does pretty well. Past couple of days, I've been writing a few that were just absolutely horrible. I just ended up writing them myself. You know, just get so frustrated, and you're like, I am just going to do this myself. So I am personally trying to spend more time training it because I, as anybody knows that has used it, it is not foolproof. It makes a lot of mistakes, but it gets better with training. So I am actually trying to spend the time to give it feedback and train it more. But yeah, sometimes it's just horrible.
Yeah. And when you say training, there's kind of two models of training, right? You can train a model where you're actually putting like questions, like inputs and then outputs to try to really fine tune the model itself. But then you can also, in just the ChatGPT window, give it context, give it feedback. Here's examples. I'm guessing you're talking about the latter version of that. Or are you actually training your custom model for this?
Yep. More on the contextual side of things.
Got it. Man, do you ever use it? How much do you use it for psychological background? Like it's so hard. I imagine if we're talking about, like, let's say this, you know, let's use a solar panel installers again, like we can understand some of, or at least guess some of the issues that they may have in terms of those things. But there's probably a lot of things that I would imagine you don't even think about unless you're doing that. And nothing's going to be actually being in somebody's mind, but given that's impossible, do you use ChatGPT very much from a psychological perspective to say, hey, tell me about the things that such and such are worried about, or what are the, you know, for, like you've mentioned, driving that heart into the, you know, the knife into the fear and the pain and embracing that, like, what are some of the worries people have? Like, how much are you using it to get inside the mind of prospective clients psychologically?
You know, I haven't been using ChatGPT yet for that. And the main reason is that two of the questions in my, you know, 12 question survey ask my clients explicitly what keeps their target customer up at night. So that has already been answered. Honestly, I think my clients probably know better at this point, or I hope they do. If I have picked them correctly, they know better than I do about those worries. So I haven't used it yet. That is a good idea. I might start kind of getting some feedback from it, but my clients, I still think, will probably always know better.
You've got, like I mentioned earlier, Prompt Pod, which is a podcast all about prompt engineering and AI in general. Biggerprompts.com is the website for that, or you can just, I'm sure you can find it on Apple or perhaps maybe even Spotify. What are some of the things that, talk about a few things that you've learned and that you're covering on that podcast. One that maybe we can start with is, copyright related to some of the data sets. I think that's a really interesting idea, and I think it's going to become more problematic in the future. Talk a little bit about that and what you've learned there and kind of some of the issues that are arising.
Yeah, I have recorded a few podcasts now about kind of copyright ethics and legality, and I have a few more scheduled for the next coming few weeks about it too. So yeah, it's very interesting. Everyone refers back to the Napster days where it was impossible to limit the sharing of data. There were MP3s that could just be emailed around. It was just kind of impossible to regulate. So similar things are happening right now. These data sets are not fully licensed or licensed at all, as far as I'm aware, or have been told. And so then the question of where did this information come from? Have these people been compensated? What happens to the creation that is new from an amalgamation of all this data, as far as copywriting goes, is kind of a big question in the field. It does seem like at some point, a lot of people are talking about, you know, verifiable data, fully licensed data, and also, you know, registered data, knowing that something was from a good data set or that an AI produced it from some certain type of data is kind of a lot of the conversations that I've been having over the past couple of weeks.
Have you got into data signatures yet? Or like I thought about this originally from the perspective of if ChatGPT, you know, they have those AI detection tools, which seem like they kind of work maybe directionally, but have a wild degree, wild levels of inaccuracy in them, or at least some. But like the idea of an AI or some kind of fingerprint in a text, you know, a series of text or in a data set that you can detect. And obviously it can't be super obvious, otherwise people just remove it. But has that been a topic that's come up at all in any of the conversations you've had?
Yep, absolutely. Multiple people have mentioned that. Nobody quite knows how to do it yet. I think there would have to be a consensus from the biggest players on the planet to do that. But it's, at least to me, it seems like it must happen at some point, not only for providing good data, compensating people, but in all reality, knowing what's real and what is fake, I think will be very important in the near future.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how they do that, because on one hand, you think about it, like if you create, having that be effective, you need to have, it needs to be a level of secrecy around it. And so I wonder if keeping it, like having lots of large institutions know that to be able to collaborate and have an industry standard, you'd have to, it'd be hard to keep that kind of that fingerprint secret. Or maybe it works like a kind of like a private and public keys do. I'm not sure. It's kind of way outside my league here, but it'd be fascinating to see how that evolves. And it would be really nice to have something that you can tell is either human generated or AI generated.
Hey, I remember you mentioned the other day, this might be the second rise of the NFT here soon.
I think so. Well, at least in terms of, you know, NFTs had their day, but they're amazing for granting digital ownership over something, right? So I think that was my thoughts on that, were less so about is this AI generated, but more so about saying like, am I a human? Is this content human generated? So if you can have some kind of public standard, because we have, you know, kind of public and private keys and encryption right now that works perfectly for this. It's what an NFT is, more or less. And so being able to say, hey, this tweet or this image or this statement I just made was from me. So kind of like if you can think about verified accounts on steroids, but across all sorts of mediums. I'm not quite sure how that would look. But yeah, I think the technology is you know, potentially ready to come back or at least be more utilized in that way. So, because yeah, we're going to start seeing a lot of crazy stuff pop up. Like for example, I'm going to play a little clip here. This was something that so Steve Chu, good friend of mine, but we always prank each other. If you're at ECF Live, you heard this. But this is a clip that using a tool called 11 Labs, I downloaded 20 minutes of Steve's podcast, and in about 20 minutes, maybe 15, was able to write out a script and have it come out in his voice exactly. So give this a listen really quickly here.
Hey, Andrew, it's Steve here. I've been feeling really bad about all the teasing and pranking. I started everything years ago. We both know that. And this whole prank war is 100% my fault. You've just been trying to defend yourself like any reasonable person would against a bully. I also feel bad that ECF Live is becoming so much about me. It should be focused on your members instead of these silly pranks I started. I mean, I really like the attention, but also kind of feel bad that everyone coming has to hear so much about me. I'd like to apologize for all my immaturity and offer to end this. I promise no more pranks from here on out. And to make it up to all the ECF members who had to watch this spectacle, I'm buying drinks and meals for anyone who asks me during the event. It's the least I can do for causing so much drama. Appreciate you putting up with me, Andrew. I promise to be a better man going forward. Thanks, man.
So it's pretty wild. Like, I mean, Steve can tell it's him. And if you listen carefully, it's especially maybe with headphones on, you can tell it's not quite right, but it is pretty close. And so the level of, I mean, I'm sure everyone's starting to see these all over the place with voice fakes or video fakes or everything or deep fakes. But it wasn't, what surprised me wasn't so much that it was available to make, but how literally 15 minutes it took me to make this, which is just wild.
Yeah, it's incredible. And just on the kind of creativity side of things, and another incredible story I heard on a recent interview I did was the person I was talking to, his daughter was having a birthday coming up. So he used ChatGPT to write a brand new children's story, which took, he said, a decent amount of editing. It certainly wasn't perfect. Used Midjourney to create the artwork for the book, and for $120 made 4 copies of the book and gave it to his daughter for her birthday. So stuff like that, it's just incredible to me.
It's really cool. I think on the AI front, like what becomes more valuable, this is something I've been thinking more about. I think creativity becomes more valuable because if all the tools are there, lowers the level of, you don't have to be an artist. You just have to be able to understand how to prompt things, or you have to have the vision for it. And you have to know how to kind of convey that in, you know, like Midjourney has its own kind of language, but I think creativity becomes more valuable. I think unique data sets become more valuable because if all the AI is just generally feeding off of the web or images or whatever it is, and you have a unique data set that's kind of, that's fenced off somewhere, that's really valuable. Danny, what else do you think is, I think in person and community is becoming, it will become more valuable because at least, man, hope, you know, really, really knock on wood here, but hopefully we're quite a ways away from AI being able to deeply connect emotionally with people. It's going to be rough when that happens. But yeah, anything else that you think, Danny, that is just becoming more valuable with the emergence of AI and some of these tools making things so easy?
You know, in a relative perspective, blue-collar work.
Yeah.
What was it? 6 months ago, back in the good old days, everyone was freaked out about AI taking blue-collar jobs. And I don't think that's been mentioned in the past 6 months. So yeah, after this podcast, I'm actually going to go get a blue-collar job.
people were worried about it taking blue-collar jobs a while ago. I always, of course, like the white-collar jobs have always been on the chopping block. I don't see why were people worried about the blue-collar, kind of someone fixing your plumbing or putting a new roof on or whatever it was.
Or I think it was mainly the truck drivers and things like that with autonomous vehicles, yeah, and AI. Yes. And that is the most common job in the US. So that was a big fear for a while, and rightfully so. And it probably still is a fear and should be. But yeah, ironically, that hasn't been mentioned in a while. I actually had my good buddy back from Georgia who has an oil and convenience store company. And I'm like, you know, not only do those stores, are they really evergreen in recessions, but also it's just like, man, an AI is going to take a long time to touch his business.
Yeah, interesting. As we wrap up here, who are a couple of people that you follow on Twitter, podcasts that you think are having interesting conversations about AI, or if someone was, if they haven't gone as deep and they'd like to, jumping off points for people or people you found have interesting ideas about this in the space?
Yeah, so the top two would certainly be Ezra Klein and Lex Friedman. Both those guys have podcasts under their own name. There's a bunch of people I follow on Twitter. Realistically, you would probably just Google AI or prompt engineering in Twitter, or you would Twitter that. I'm not sure if that's the verb. But Ezra Klein, Lex Friedman, both those guys, I respect them a lot for bringing guests on from both ends of the spectrum. So one week it'll be pro AI, and the next week it'll be like, hey guys, we got to stop this side, sort of thing. So been using a lot of those discussions to kind of inform my own opinions, very level-headed, not really fear-mongering, which I'm very against. So I've been really enjoying both those guys' podcasts lately.
You can check out the podcast again, biggerprompts.com. And the name of the podcast is Prompt Pod. So we'll link up to it in the show notes, but make sure you give it a listen. And then if you happen to be in the market for some B2B direct outbound email, kirkco.io is Kirk & Co.'s website and Danny's website. So if you want to tap a little bit of this expertise for your own business, you can reach out to him. Danny, I'd love to kind of end this with a lightning round per kind of tradition. So I'm going to fire about half a dozen questions at you, and feel free to just give me short and sweet answers if that sounds good to you.
Let's go.
All right. How do you describe the AI environment in 1 to 3 words right now?
exciting and scary.
Who do you like better, me or Pete?
Oh, man. Pete and Andrew, this is still three words, right?
Like, I know the answer to this. I just want to put you on record as lying. This is pretty much what I wanted to do. Our other good friend. What's one of the fondest memories from your childhood?
Family trips to Europe. And to be a bit more verbose, my parents were both in academics, definitely pinched pennies, but we lived frugally as kids and had simple lives. But each year they saw the importance of taking their kids to Europe to kind of have a cultural experience. So those were some of the fondest memories and something that I definitely appreciate more kind of looking back now.
What's the hardest part of your business?
Picking clients, I would say, because yet again, if the client is amazing and they have good product market fit, my job is easy. If they're not, it's just going to be a painful experience.
How much money in the bank is enough? And I'm currently starting to diversify this question. You can either answer one of two ways, really, because the essence of the question is how much is enough? So you can either be a dollar figure of like money and like, you know, liquid net worth. So stocks, cash in the bank that you could live off the earnings or interest of, or just an annual income that you're like, if I had this annually, didn't have to worry about it. If I had more, great. But like, so what, how much would be enough? Where if you had more, be nice. But if you weren't, you could have you'd be totally fine and never need to have another penny in your life.
Yeah, probably gut reaction would be like 100K in annual income. So that's probably the gut.
What, we had a bet when you closed on your house about how long it was going to take you to move in after completely renovating the whole thing. I think you had 2 or 3 months as your date. I think I was more in the 4 or 5 month range. I happened to win that bet. So I'm wondering, what are you going to buy me for lunch for that? I mean, you get to pick the restaurant. Where are we going for that winning?
I think it's probably the nicest javelina steak in Tucson. So we might have to go on a hunting trip, but I'm looking for the gamiest javelina we can get.
Javelina, for those who don't know, javelina is a wild pig. It's probably not a pig, but it looks like a pig, a wild pig that is in the desert here and also kind of occasionally comes into town. So that, actually, I mean, I could see that javelina sounds kind of interesting. I'd be up for that. How many hours a week do you work on average?
I would say around 20.
You've always impressed me. You seem to be extremely efficient. You know, I always tease you for getting up at like 4:30 a.m., working for 3 or 4 hours or, you know, even less, being done. And then also having a lot of other time for other pursuits in life, which is really cool. This is kind of a side question that's blowing up the lightning around, but what do you really focus on either in terms of either making sure you do or cut out to make that work? Because I think that's something that a lot of people talk about having a really good work life, you know, not just having working all the time, but you've been able to create a life and an income that doesn't require you working 70 hours a week. So how do you do that?
Yeah. So I actually saw a great tweet by Nat Leeson on Twitter. I'm not quite sure if that's how you pronounce his last name, but he put it really well in it. It was, don't worry about optimization and efficiency. Just try to find something that you can't help but pour your time into and that you enjoy. I thought that was so true. So like, yeah, usually I'm shooting for a couple hours a day of work. I like to work like 2 to 3 hours a day. This past 6 months with endless painting of this new house, Kirk & Co. plus starting this podcast, you know, it could have been like 90 to 100 hours per week. But honestly, I was having fun at all of those and it never really felt like work. So my goal in life is just to, like, when my eyes open every day, I can't help but not get out of bed. Like, that is what I'm going for.
That's cool. What's your number one hobby? And you can't say either work when you can't say fixing up your house, because that is hopefully done and I know it's consumed a lot of your time. So apart from those two pursuits, what's your top hobby or interest?
I got back into bouldering now. I cycled back into climbing. So I've been doing a lot of bouldering lately and enjoying getting back into that.
Oh, nice. Where do you go bouldering in town? Is it Ropes and what's the name of that place?
It's Rocks and Ropes. It's not Ropes and Ropes. So yeah, Rocks and Ropes.
Rocks and Ropes. Excuse me. Got it. And then finally, who's one of the most interesting people you've met through the Prompt Pod?
Ooh, just had a great conversation this morning with Michael Osterreiter from Visual. I think he's German, I believe, and they're in Portugal. I hit end on the recording and then we talked for another 15 minutes and agreed to immediately schedule our next podcast. So that one was definitely really enjoyable. Kind of one of those ones where it's hard to end it.
That's very cool. Well, Danny, thank you for coming on. This has been super fun. Of course, selfishly, I always enjoy talking and hanging out, especially fun to do it and kind of, you know, just mine you for information for close to better part of an hour here. But again, kirkko.io is his consulting site based around direct and outbound cold emailing. And then biggerprompts.com is the website for Prompt Pod, his podcast on all things AI and understanding prompt engineering. So Danny, thanks for doing this. Super fun, and looking forward to seeing you around the neighborhood more, man. It's good to have you. Good to have you close by.
Likewise, Andrew. Thanks very much.
Given you've made it to the end of the episode, there's a pretty good chance you're fairly serious about this e-commerce stuff, which is why you should check out the E-commerce Fuel community. It's a vetted, vibrant community for 7- and 8-figure brand owners. And joining gives you access to a lively discussion forum for experienced founders sharing insights and getting help, access to our library of over 20,000 member reviews on everything from agencies to tech to lawyers to all the things that, you know, founders are making hiring decisions or purchasing decisions on to run their business, and invites to member events throughout the year. So if that sounds interesting, you can apply for membership and learn more at ecommercefuel.com. Big thanks to One-Click Upsell from Zipify Apps. Rapidly increase your AOV by offering targeted high-converting upsells. You can get started with them at ecommercefuel.com/upsell. And also to Fulfill.io, an ERP designed specifically to streamline complex e-commerce businesses and the highest rated ERP among our community members. Learn more at ecommercefuel.com/fulfill. Thanks so much for listening. Work hard, adventure often, and I'm looking forward to seeing you again next Friday.
This is the ASY Radio Network, live from New York.